Yesterday, we discussed the first Mishnah of Pirkei Avot, the first Mishnah where we traced the origins of the transmission of Torah from generation to generation all the way back to Moshe. And we discussed in length the first words of the Mishnah, which told us Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. Moshe was the greatest prophet of all time, one of the fundamental beliefs that Maimonides establishes, that we understand that Moses transmitted the Torah faithfully in its entirety from God to the Jewish people without any self-interpretation. There was nothing obfuscated in the vision and the clarity with which he was given everything. We discussed a little bit what the Talmud tells us about that transmission between God and Moses, and we discussed the primary character trait that Moshe had, that Moses had, above and beyond everybody else, why he merited to be able to be the greatest prophet of all time, which was humility. And we talked a little bit about humility and how great Torah wisdom invariably has to come with humility, because the more we accentuate the I and the more we consider ourselves Mr. Somebody, the more our brain is now finite and cannot really, is now going to not have the tools to absorb infinite wisdom. Infinite transcendent wisdom requires the expansion of the spirit, the expansion of the mind, the diminutation of the big I. The more I think I'm a somebody, I've got it, I have it, it's all about me, the more distant I am from the divine and from his infinite knowledge. That was a little bit of what we discussed yesterday, and we gave a couple of examples, if I recall. We ended off the class with a couple of examples of how really great people were always the most humble of people, and they were involved in the individual. They weren't interested in gaining the headlines and looking for self-promotion techniques and trying to get publicity on the cheap. They shied and shunned publicity. They looked away from it. Someone just told me yesterday a story that was told to him by the rabbi whom it happened to, who once decided, the fellow, one of his congregants, decided he was going to travel to New York to visit Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Feinstein was the greatest Torah sage, the greatest halachic sage of our post-war generation. Very humble man. He lived in the same apartment building as my wife's grandfather. I told you a little bit about him. Exceptionally fine, simple, gentle, involved in the individual. We've mentioned a couple of stories yesterday how involved he was in the individual. So he went to the east side, to the yeshiva that Rav Moshe was the Rosh Yeshiva of, to visit him. And he went to Davin Shachris in the yeshiva. He'd never seen Rabbi Feinstein before. He didn't know what he looked like. And he came early in the morning and he sat in the synagogue together with his son. He was bringing his son along to see Rabbi Feinstein. And he was sitting in towards near the back. And he saw the front had the various rabbis and teachers of the yeshiva. He wasn't sure which one was Rabbi Feinstein. So, at the end of davening, he went over to someone and he said, "Which one on the front is Rabbi Feinstein? We came to get a blessing from him. We want to know who he is." So the fellow pointed to Rabbi Feinstein. He was very small, looked very diminutive, looked very small, very unassuming fellow. "That's him." The fellow was shocked. He went white. He said, "That was him. Oh my." He came up the aisle before and he was coming towards me. And I figured he wanted a donation, so I took out of my pocket a quarter and I put it in his hand. I didn't realize he was coming to say shalom to me. And he took it and he put it in his pocket and he walked on. He said, "Thank you." Oh my. That's genuine greatness. That's genuine greatness. Can you imagine the parallel today in our world? I mean, who would be the parallel? I know, the president of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Can you imagine? I mean, we revere and Rabbi Feinstein probably on a completely different plane. But let's find some kind of a parallel in contemporary society to Rabbi Feinstein. Can you give me anyone on the Supreme Court that we can contemplate that that could happen to? Some of the judges are humble and self-effacing and great. But that's a level of greatness that you don't want to embarrass someone. And so you consider it's okay, you take the quarter and put it in your pocket as if you're the poor man that's going around rather than say something. That is genuine greatness. That's genuine humility. There was a fellow that was giving Rabbi Feinstein a ride once from the yeshiva. And he put him in the backseat of the car. And he banged the car by mistake on Rabbi Feinstein's hand. And it must have killed his hand. And he didn't say anything. He held his hand, opened the door a little, put it in, held his hand. He didn't say anything. The driver didn't realize what he'd done till he'd gotten from the yeshiva to Rabbi Feinstein's house. And he saw he was in agony. But he maintained himself. He wouldn't scream, he wouldn't say anything, because God forbid he didn't want to embarrass the driver. The driver would have been mortally ashamed. There's a genuine sensitivity and humility that goes hand in hand with Torah wisdom. That was a lot of our discussion yesterday. Moses accepted the Torah from Sinai. We talked about the word accepting rather than it was handed over to him as God, because there was no it, there was no him, there was no independent entity. I want to discuss, our time is limited today, so if we can hold the questions for a little bit, we're going to discuss today where we left off. And that was that the men of the great assembly left us three teachings, three primary teachings for future generations. And we talked on the historical chronological chain of tradition where the men of the great assembly came in. They came in after the prophets. They marked the end of the era of prophecy in the Jewish people, the end of the Nevi'im that recorded their prophecies for posterity. We have the scriptures. After that was the men of the great assembly. And in fact, the Talmud tells us that the men of the great assembly engineered the end of prophecy. They engineered the end of prophecy. They were the ones that actually brought it about. How did that happen? Well, the Talmud tells us that the men of the great assembly that lived in the towards the end of the first temple, beginning of the second temple period, spanned that 150 years, an august body of the greatest rabbis amongst the Jewish people that gathered together in one assembly and instituted various safeguards to preserve Jewish law and tradition. They were the ones that established the format of prayer that we have today. The Shemona Esrei, the 18 blessings, came from the men of the great assembly. Great men, brilliant men, spiritual giants. And they gathered together and they decided they had to do something to arrest the spiritual decline that had taken hold in the Jewish people. So you know what they did? The Jewish people had a huge temptation for idolatry. As we read, it's the most fascinating thing. We read all of Shoftim and Yeshua Shoftim, Melachim, the whole first temple period was marked by times of great spiritual greatness among the Jewish people, a return to tradition, a return to the faith, and then an idolatrous wave sweeps over the people, and they succumb to the temptations of the Baal and all the various idol worship, idolatrous cults and traits that were at that time. And it's difficult to understand, like, how could these people that were led by great leaders and that lived amongst prophets, how did they succumb to idolatry? Like, who would bow down to this arcane stone or totem pole or this idiocy that looks so lunar, looks so crazy to us? But they had an incredible urge, and we can't judge their urge to serve idolatry because we weren't in their time and we don't have that impulse. We know what the sexual urge can do to us. Can you imagine much stronger urge, which was the urge for idolatry in those days? So much so that King Manasseh, the son of King Chizkiyahu, who was a great man, And he brought a great revival of teshuva to the Jewish people. But he had a son, King Manasseh, who was the most wicked of all the kings. And he totally erased all vestiges of Torah study and learning amongst the Jewish people and legislated everybody has to go and serve idols. And he set up idol houses all over the land of Israel. He was a wicked man. And the Talmud gives a fascinating story how, I believe it was Rav Papa, one of the great Amoraim, was once learning, teaching with his students, and he said to them, tomorrow we're going to talk about that wicked king, King Manasseh. And he spoke about him in a very derogatory fashion. I'm going to talk about him. And that night, King Manasseh came to him in a dream, the Talmud says, and he said to him, what did you say about me? So he said, well, you were such a wicked king. And we read in the scriptures how you led the people astray after idolatrous practices in a terrible way. You were rotten. So he said, don't talk about me. If you would have lived in my time, you would have lifted the hem of your coat to run a little bit faster towards the house of idolatry. In other words, we can't judge anybody else. And so when we look at these earlier generations that were so sucked into this idolatrous practice, it's hard for us to even begin to appreciate what it was, but we can't judge them negatively. But to explain it and to put it a little bit into context, we can understand it. You know, when you have little kids, you'll see this, please God. But a child, the first time it's called reverse child psychology. If you want them to do something, you tell them just the opposite. Because they will assert their independence immediately. Yesterday my kid was screaming because I was lifting her up from the house to get her onto the school bus. She didn't want to be lifted up. She wanted to walk on her own. Like, there are actually stages that psychologists talk about within a child's development where there are various stages where they need much more to assert their independence, and they need to assert their independence because they are so dependent in reality. And the more dependent we are in reality on someone else, the more we want to sever the umbilical tie and assert our independence and demonstrate that we don't need them, because there's nothing more damaging to my ego than to know that I'm a nobody. And I'm totally dependent on someone else. And so we find when the Jewish people, as soon as they entered into the land of Israel, right away they were lured into idolatrous practices, various lower elements and segments of the people. And Moses in Deuteronomy warns the people again and again and again, you're going to go into the land and you're going to face this incredible temptation to serve idols. Don't let your heart be led astray. The whole of Deuteronomy is replete with admonishments and warnings, and double warnings and triple warnings. Don't be led astray by idolatry. And it was precisely because they saw God so clearly. He was right there in their face. And they had no self-choice. They had to serve God because it was so clear. Not serving God was like putting your hand in fire. So they kicked the whole fire. And they needed a way out. That was their way of exercising their freedom and independence by serving idols. It's hard for us to understand it, but it puts it a little bit better in context that it wasn't because they were simply looking for a New Age religion and they had no connection to God and they were just lost or bewildered and so on. They understood God so profoundly and so intimately that created an incredible challenge. And so therefore they lusted idol worship with which they were free and unshackled. They could rationalize that independent urge that was beneath the surface. And the men of the great assembly, the Talmud tells us, saw that the people were being led astray after idolatry. And it was so damaging that the future of the Jewish people was threatened. And so together they prayed to God to abolish the drive, the internal drive to idolatry. And the Talmud says that God accepted their prayer. The Talmud even describes how they were able to see that incredible lust and urge leave this world. They could see it in a visual sense. But all of a sudden, there was relief. Total relief. Everybody's idolatrous hormones were expunged. They could now live free with God. In fact, the Talmud says that they saw they were successful. They figured like, okay, now let's get rid of the sexual urge. Now, there will be no more incest, and no more rape, and no more violent immorality, or no more immorality. And they heard a heavenly voice and said, don't take that away, because then the purpose of mankind, the real challenge, it'll be gone forever. That's no good. Man needs to battle that impulse and be able to maintain fidelity within a marital relationship and so on. That's important. Don't take that away. So that stayed. But the force of idolatry, which we obviously can't relate to because we don't have that internal drive at all, that was there precisely because of their greatness. And so the Talmud says, you know, it's like when you take a tablet, every drug has after a side effect, impossible. What were the side effects when the rabbis abolished, when the men of the Great Assembly abolished the internal drive for idolatry?
Loss of prophecy.
Loss of prophecy. Because precisely because the nation was on such a high awareness of God, that's why they had the urge for idolatry. And if you take away the urge for idolatry, the world is finely attuned. It's like a balance, it's scales. There is positive energy and negative energy, and there's always that balance that we have to find the middle ground and be able not to let the negative energy outsway the positive. The world is like a battery. Any positive, good force in this world is generated by the fusion of opposite forces. Everything. Man and woman come together. They're opposite forces, trust me. And a child is born. They find unity. Rain comes and meets the ground and germinates the seed that's in beneath the ground. There is nothing that is created without the fusion of different elements. Opposites. The whole world is opposites. Internally, within me, there is two forces. There's a desire to do good, and there's a desire to do bad, and indulge myself, and be this materialistic animal, and let my payers down, and live out all my fantasies. And then there's this good force that wants to be good, and caring, and sharing, and live with a conscience. And I'm engaged in the battle, as is everyone else. And the more good there is, the more knowledge there is, the more awareness of God there is, the greater the other side needs to be lifted up. Otherwise, my muscles aren't strengthening. And the more internal desire there is to be led astray. So therefore, by overcoming that negativity and releasing the positive energy, I am now growing and there's a forward movement. Forward movement is always generated by the fusion of those opposites. And if the force for idolatry was diminished, the negative energy was diminished in the Jewish people, the positive energy was also naturally diminished. And so there was a precipitous drop in the spiritual greatness of the Jewish people with the era of the men of the August Great Assembly, because they abolished the drive for idol worship. And therefore, in their generation, they determined it was necessary to commit the oral law to writing, because people's spiritual sensitivity and their awareness and their minds weren't as clear and as connected to the Torah, to the oral law. And they said, okay, we've got to start writing the oral law. That's where the Mishnah began to evolve from. They started writing it, the Talmud says, on little pieces of paper, just rulings. And slowly but surely, as the spiritual sensitivity receded more and the people regressed, they wrote more and more to ensure that the Torah will not be forgotten, the oral law. There are various other byproducts of a less spiritually sensitive generation. People lose objectivity. Great people that have less eye can be more objective, more subjective. The bigger the eye, the more I'm always tuned into WIFM. What's in it for me? Naturally. The more I am unable to be totally objective. So the men of the Great Assembly told the people, Hevu Mesunim Badin, be slow to judge, be deliberate in judgment. Don't jump to conclusions, because your first natural instinct isn't necessarily so pure. You have to winnow and sift it through now. The generations have receded. And not only that, you can't rely on the natural transmission of Torah values, because there are forces in the world outside. The people are less spiritually sensitive, and it's not naturally going to go over. You have to impart and imbibe in students with greater involvement. It's like a little candle. In the olden times, they said you could just touch the wick. The wick had lots of paraffin and wax around it. You just needed to just tap it with the flame and it burst into a flame. But today, it's not surrounded with all those combustible materials. You need to put the flame there and keep it there until it goes up. It takes time. The Hamidu Talmidim Harba, make stand many students. Don't rely on the fact that you think you've given it over and they've gotten it. They haven't gotten it, because the minds are weaker. And furthermore, we need a protective fence around the Torah, because we can't assume that people will naturally recognize that this is high voltage. In earlier times, people understood that the Torah was like a high voltage wire, and one needed to be distant from transgressing the Torah. There was a natural respect and appreciation for the Torah's commands, but in our generation that spiritual sensitivity is gone, and so therefore we need to impose more rules, more laws, more safeguards to ensure that nobody gets electrocuted. And those are the three things that the men of the Great Assembly said. Heim Amru Shlosha Dvarim. They said three things. We could read it here in the Mishnah. Hevu Mesunim Badin. Be slow. Mesunim Badin. Be slow to judge. Some say that the word Mesunim means Nesunim. It means put yourself in the place of the accused, of the defendant. Don't naturally assume that we can judge someone else. I have to put myself in his shoes, because we can't be objective. We can't really understand and appreciate other people because we're so engaged and invested in ourselves. The Hamidu Talmidim Harba, bring up many students. Don't rely on the natural transmission of Torah. It requires more work. And make a fence around the Torah. We can't assume that people are going to keep the Torah naturally. Very beautiful. So these three teachings really were reflective of the challenge of the times that the men of the Great Assembly lived in. Heaven Masunim Badin. We've got to be slow to judge. They say a story of a wagon driver that had to drive merchandise, a big wagon full of textiles and merchandise, and he had to drive it from Warsaw all the way to Russia, St. Petersburg. It was very important, and he had an important consignment. He was going to be paid for this journey, 100 rubles. It's a lot of money. But the problem was, he didn't realize it was right before Passover, and the roads were extremely muddy. And he was a simple wagon driver, and when he assessed the price, he wasn't thinking so carefully, but the journey took him double as long. The carriage, the axle got broken over the mud. The roads in those days were very muddy. It was after the rainy season, the snow had melted. It was a horrendous ride. And he came to St. Petersburg and he wanted to charge the company for the delivery 200 rubles. It wasn't fair. He said, this is not a 100 ruble trip, this is a 200 ruble trip. So they went to the rabbi. And the rabbi said to him, it was a great rabbi, and the rabbi said to him, you made up 100 rubles, you'll have to suffer the loss. The wagon driver was a simple fellow, nice, good Jew, didn't know much. So he says to the rabbi, he says, well, where do you know that from? So the rabbi said, well, I know that because it's Jewish law. So he said, well, where is it Jewish law? So he says, it's written in Maimonides, in the Rambam, in the Mishneh Torah. So he said, Maimonides, tell me, was he a wagon driver? So he said, no, he wasn't a wagon driver. He was a great scholar. He was a philosopher. He was a great man. So he said, well, how did he know what it's like to drive a carriage around rocky roads and muddy roads? Where did he get the ruling from? So he said, Maimonides took it from the Talmud, from the Gemara. It's the Gemara, Nasoches Umnin, that if you make up a price, even if the conditions change, you're duty bound to honor the agreement. So he said, the Gemara, were the Gemara people that wrote it, were they wagon drivers? So he said, no! They were great scholars. So he said, well, how did they know? So he said, well, they got it from the Torah. The Torah. Okay. Is it written in the Torah? He said, yes. So he said, tell me, when was the Torah given to the Jewish people? So he said, don't you know, it was given Shavuos to the Jewish people on the 7th of Sivan at Sinai. So he said, now I get it. I understand. The Torah was given at Sivan when the roads are dry and everything is good. If it would have been given in the winter, boy, I would be right. So some people always see it their way. It's very hard to transition into someone else's mindset. And that's our natural disposition. We need to see things and we want to bend things to conform to the way we want to see them. We're all naturally disposed to our own way of thinking. It's very difficult. We'd be willing to bend anything and everything. I've seen people that are so objective until it comes to themselves. It's just human nature. So, the first time where people significantly lost their objectivity was when that awareness of Hashem was so strictly and strongly diminished with the men of the Great Assembly with that era. And therefore they taught, Hevel Masunim Bedin, be very slow and deliberate in effecting judgment. Be slow to think, we've got to pause and winnow it through and make sure that we're rendering the right judgment. And when we bring up students, we can't assume that they understand. We have to explain it again and again because their minds are not as clear as the earlier generations. Furthermore, we can't assume that naturally the Torah is going to be guarded and safeguarded and kept. We have to put a little fence around the Torah. Guys, we're going to leave it here. And we're going to continue tomorrow on the second Mishnah, the words of Shimon HaTzadik.